Welcome everyone to today's webinar, Tools to Resolve Tough Issues in Your Community. This is Thursday, November 9th, and we're delighted that so many of you have joined us today for this session. It's sponsored by the ICMA Coaching Program, and we're especially delighted that we have platinum sponsor ICMA-RC. ICMA-RC is dedicated to helping each of you realize your success in this career, and they build public sector retirement security. We also have ICMA and Cal-ICMA as gold sponsors, and we're delighted that we have 26 state association coaching partners. You can see them there. They work with us to identify topics, presenters, and to encourage engagement at the local level in the opportunities for coaching to serve you and to serve the profession. So thank you all for participating. We also are pleased to have outreach partners that assist us in gaining as broad and diverse and inclusive an audience as possible. So we're very thankful that they're out and working with us to help this be successful. So today's session is really covering the controversial issues that arise in local government and what are some best practices and effective ways that you can develop a skill set to address them, as well as some principles and frameworks that you can apply. So in that regard, we're very fortunate today to have an outstanding panel. We have Eric Jensen. Eric has over 20 years of experience as a public administrator, project manager, public affairs consultant, and now is a principal and founder of Jensen Strategies that address policy and organizational development issues for local government. And he is an MPA from the University of Washington. He's going to be laying out a framework for you to think about the tough issues that you face, some guiding principles for doing that, so that whatever the topics are that you're dealing with, you'll find something in his presentation that will help you frame and understand what the opportunities are and how to address them. Then we're going to be going to two specific case studies that are important not only for the content of the case study and the specific circumstances, but the lessons that you can learn from them about how to address other issues. And they really cover two broad categories. One, Holly Lee is going to be dealing with the chronic issues that cities face and the communities that cities serve face. And that's the issue in her particular circumstance in Charlottesville of underemployment and poverty. And I know there are many other issues that are similar, like homelessness or opioid crisis, et cetera, where there are major challenges that communities face, and sometimes they turn to their local government as a vehicle for addressing those. And so what can local governments do in that context? How can you be a player, and how can you do that effectively? It's not your typical picking up the trash or providing water or sewer or public safety in a narrowly defined way, but it's a very important one. And then we're going to be wrapping up with Kip Harkness on another element of the spectrum of tough issues, and that is what happens when circumstances throw you something from left field. In his case, he's going to be talking about a flood situation, but how they dealt with it in San Jose is really insightful in terms of the techniques and approaches that are applicable to other sorts of crises and challenges that you might face. And I'm Don Mariska, pleased to be director of the ICMA Coaching Program and moderator and organizer of these sessions. So pleased to have all of you with us today. So we're going to do a series of polling questions. This is our way of getting interactivity with you. So the first one that's coming up here is a polling question around how many folks are at your location. We want that not only to know what our audience is, but we've made a big effort this year, and we're going to be redoubling that effort next year to encourage communities of learning in your local agencies. And the best way to do that, we found, is to get a group of people to come together, listen to and participate in these webinars, and then have discussion afterwards, which is why we always have polling questions at the end of various segments, and why we also have the post-webinar discussion questions to engage you along the way. So we leave about a minute open for each of these. Again, if you've just checked in, we're delighted to have all of you joining us here today. I want to highlight to you that we do have the materials from today's session available in the handout section of GoToWebinar, and we also have that online at the archives tab of icma.org/coachingwebinars. So If you weren't the one to register and didn't get all that information, that's where you can go and look for it, and we'll also be sending that out again to registrants afterwards so that you can find everything that you need. So let's take a look at our audience and see what we've got in terms of results here. I see that three-quarters of you there are there on your own. We're delighted to have every one of you, and others in groups of varying sizes. I know I got communications from a number of agencies that are bringing 30 or more people into their council chamber to watch on a big screen and to discuss these topics together, so we're pleased to have all of you here. So let me take a look now at our first presentation, and I'm going to be turning over the advancing of the slides to Eric Jensen. And Eric, thank you so much for being with us today. We're pleased to have you and your insights.
All right. Well, thank you, Don, and thank you for the opportunity to participate in this panel. I will give the quick caveat here at the very beginning of this that this is the first time I've done a webinar, and I'm not used to not seeing the audience out there, so I will do my best to make my way through this and not being able to see the reaction of the audience. But what I'd like to talk today about is looking at some of the generic issues around controversial or tough community issues in your communities. And sorry, I'm trying to make sure that I can progress the slide here. Okay, we're back on. So I'm hoping that everybody will take away from this three different things. One is the importance of having your house in order and the importance of having your organization in order, enabling you to most effectively take advantage of addressing these issues when they come up. Secondly, different issues require different approaches. There's no panacea or a panacea tool that's going to address everything, although there are approaches that have some commonalities. And the last thing is to start thinking about controversies as opportunities that can benefit both your organization and your community. So, sorry, I'm having a little technical issue here. There we go. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what a controversy is or what some of the tough issues are that you may encounter. And, sort of skip through here. There we go. The media does a fantastic job of bringing visibility to controversy. And what I like to talk about is, when you get past that hyperbole, what are those controversies? What are those things that you typically run across? So, from my perspective, there are four elements of a tough issue or a controversial issue. One is that they have significant public discourse, that it's generated a lot of chat within your community. That it affects and impacts a significant portion of your community, a significant segment of your community, or in terms of a broad geographic area. And that it has the potential to hinder your local government's ability to deliver services. And finally, ultimately, potentially can erode the credibility of your local government. So, what are those challenging issues that local governments face? The first thing I'd like to point out is that there are different types of controversies, and I lump them into two different categories. The first category are those controversies that you can see coming. You have time to plan for it. You have time to kind of think about what your approach is and the direction that you want to take. And then there are those that just flat out hit you upside the head. And they come in my experience, into four different categories in terms of the anticipated ones, the ones that you can see coming, two of those having to do with facility siting, the public facility siting of those unpopular facilities such as jails, wastewater treatment plants, and the like that trigger the NIMBY syndrome. The other is private facility siting. And for those of you who have recently gone through legalizing recreational marijuana, there may be issues around the siting of marijuana dispensaries. Walmart is always also a hot topic given their perceived labor practices, strip clubs, and then there are many others that can fall into this category. Land use changes are another one. In terms of, are you going out and doing annexation and animal ordinances, we've recently seen being pretty controversial as people want to have chickens and various animals in their yards. And interestingly enough, one- and two-way street conversions tend to generate a lot of issues as well. And utility rate increases kind of go without saying. And so then you move into those that are hitting you out of left field, and those tend to be things such as the exposure of illegal, unethical, or gross negligence activities that are happening within your organization, whether it's a case of a software program that goes down that impacts a good number of your customers, or whether it's a issue of a whistleblower that comes forward, rightly or wrongly, with regard to some of the issues problems that they see in your organization. Public safety is the other one. And public safety, we've seen a lot of this in the news in the last year in terms of police-citizen conflict. But you also have issues like water quality in terms of if your water supply is somehow contaminated. And that can bring about, obviously, some significant controversy. And dramatic infrastructure failure, things like collapsing bridges, such as we saw some years back in Minneapolis. Some of the trends that we're seeing that are contributing to some of these tough issues, public finance, particularly the lack of public funding to maintain infrastructure, contributes to this. Land use conflicts, as we grow in population, there's more competition for how land use is used and competing interests. And probably more recently in the last year or two, social and political conflicts are contributing as well. And we're seeing that in our work with local governments. What's happening on a national level is also beginning and is permeating into the local level as well. So
I'm going to go over to a polling question here because we're interested in what types of tough issues are most concerned for your agency. So you've seen a typology here from Eric about the kinds of issues that are out there, and we're interested in seeing from you by having you click off as many of these are relevant, which ones are most important, because we'll try to help focus today the remainder of the webinar on things that will be especially useful to you. And again, if you have specific questions that you'd like to ask or other things, please send in something via the question function on GoToWebinar. It'll be a good opportunity for me to figure out where they fit in the overall structure. So encourage you to do that. And let's see how that's coming across. Okay, we're getting responses from quite a few of you. We'll take a few moments more. So let's see how that's going. We'll take a look at the results. Okay, so we've had that open for about a minute. Let's share the results. So a quick comment on what you're seeing there, Eric, as you go on to the rest of your section of the presentation.
Okay.
Any particular observations you've got about the polling results?
Well, obviously, the siting facilities and land use changes are up there, as well as the handling of finances and revenue shortfalls. And that's not a surprise to me, based on our experience in working with our clients. So community problems. problems in terms of underemployment and homelessness. These are definitely issues that we're seeing as well, and not a surprise at all.
Okay, so let's turn to the next steps in your presentation about how to tackle these and what are some best practices.
Fantastic. Okay, so we talk about the best practices. Again, the caveat that there is no one best practice that's going to apply to all the different types of controversies or tough issues that you're going to be dealing with in your community. But there are some commonalities in the way that you go about addressing these, and I'd like to talk about some of those commonalities first, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the tools that you may want to be considering as you move forward. So I think I moved my cursor off here. There we go. And we're not moving forward. Here we go. Okay. Sorry about that. So first of all, just in terms of keys to resolving some of your controversies, and this is one of the biggest takeaways that I would like to offer up, and that is having your house in order. Because the more you have your house in order, the better prepared you are to respond to these controversies when they arise. And it builds a foundation and a framework for addressing some of the tools that we're going to be talking about going forward. And so what I mean by having your house in order is, do you have the communication protocols in place so that you know how that's going to work within your organization? Do you understand the roles and responsibilities of the people within your organization so that you're not trying to sort those things out at the very beginning? And that comes into play and allows you at that point to identify controversial issues early, to be proactive in getting out there, and it allows you to run toward a controversy and not away from a controversy when it arises. There we go. In terms of developing your approach, there are certain things that you want to be looking at in any approach that you put together. And one is getting the facts straight, because in this day and age, with social media, facts can get skewed pretty easily. And so you have a responsibility as a local government to get those facts out there. Ascertaining and defining the issues and parameters, understanding what is the question that you're trying to answer, what is the issue that you're trying to address, so that you know when you're going to hit success. And also it helps you in your ability to communicate with your stakeholders in terms of what their role is and what they can do to help. Designate a lead person to coordinate all activities addressing legal, ethical, and public safety issues, I think goes without saying. But I want to emphasize this last point, preparing a comprehensive plan with a schedule. And before you get out there in front of some of these tough issues, you want to have an understanding of the direction that you're going to go, the steps that you're going to take in addressing that, so you can communicate that internally and externally and have a schedule for moving forward, so that you don't end up on two ends of the spectrum, one end of the spectrum being that you end up being very directive in the outcome. The other end of the spectrum is where the process rules you instead of you ruling the process. Don, I'm not sure there we go. Thank you. So let's talk about some of the tools that you might consider here as part of any of these controversies. So first of all, is getting the facts out. As I mentioned before, with social media, you have the situation where there's a lot of misinformation there, and you have a role to help try and get the right information out there using your organization website, using the social media tools that your local government employs. Is good. I want to make a quick mention there of nextdoor.com. Nextdoor.com, if you are not familiar with it, is a great tool from the standpoint that you can target specific neighborhoods as opposed to having something that is out for anybody inside or outside of your community. Getting to community interest groups and having your elected officials and spokespeople out there giving the right information. And the last one I'm going to mention is kind of traditional media is a necessary evil. I think I'm probably the only person here that's been misquoted in the paper, but it's not always accurate what comes out, but you do need to utilize that as a way of getting information out. So talking about resolution and mitigation and community dialogue, one of the things that you want to be doing is engaging your stakeholders, because the more you can engage your stakeholders in resolving a community issue, the more they're going to have ownership in it, and you will also get the benefit of hearing some of their creative ideas. Some of the tools that we've used in the past are task forces and citizen committees, speakers bureau to get out to some of the existing organizations and interest groups, using online surveys, community meeting workshops. This is certainly not an exclusive list by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly an opportunity for you to be able to get out there and to engage those folks. And I can't tell you how important that is in terms of resolving issues in your community and resolving the issues around the controversies that you're dealing with. But finding the right mix as you're going forward is going to be important. So I think we're on the next one. So the last one I want to talk about in terms of types of tools, this one is a little less traditional and kind of more creative, and it's one that I've seen is really helpful for local governments. And that is, local government is in a unique position to actually be pretty creative. And I know that's kind of counterintuitive for a lot of folks. People don't necessarily see local government as being the creative element in the picture. But there are opportunities as you look at some of these issues to be able to engage your stakeholders in finding ways to address issues. So let me just give you a couple of examples, or two, maybe three examples. In terms of facility siting, and that came up on the polling, being able to figure out ways, where can you do the value added into the project that may not be just the one thing you're trying to achieve. So take a wastewater treatment plant siting. And this is actually a real case scenario that I went through 20 years ago, where a city was trying to site a wastewater treatment plant. They had five sites that they were looking at, and they offered up to the communities that were nearby various improvements that would happen. So, for example, if a neighborhood didn't have a park or an area for recreation, that could be part of the treatment plant going in. So you put a park in there. If they have existing transportation issues, that there's transportation infrastructure things that you can do. In this particular case that we were working on, we actually had, out of the five sites, we had three of the neighborhoods competing to have the wastewater treatment plant in their neighborhood. This can happen on the private sector side as well. I was involved much earlier on in the siting and development of a sports arena, and we worked with the adjacent neighborhood to address their concerns, obviously things like parking, crime, so forth. We were able to work with the city to be able to get various improvements like street lights and parking rules and traffic mitigation plans in place to kind of help that out. Land use changes, you have opportunities there too. So annexation, I was involved in another one several years ago where the city was annexing all of its islands within the city. And as part of that process, in addition to engaging the community, and as in part as a result, they set up a program whereby taxes would be deferred, and they would grandfather in certain things, such as ability to have livestock and that sort of thing to sort of sweeten the deal. So these are great ways to go about it, and I encourage people to sort of think outside the box and think about that. So approaches to avoid very quickly. These are things that I've seen happening. One is the don't be silent. People will fill the void for you, and they'll tell you what they think you're doing. So second one is the is defensiveness and deferral. Oh, it's not my agency. It's not my local government that is the problem here. It's this one over here. Well, that doesn't do you a whole lot of good, and it makes you look more like the obstacle than the problem, and it also potentially takes you out of the mix in terms of any potential solutions that might benefit your local government, even though you may not be the primary. And the third one is denial. And that's putting your head in the sand, saying, well, this is probably going to go away if we just ignore this. And I don't know if you can read the cartoon here. It says, let's change the brink of chaos to everything is wonderful. So moving forward, we have I threw down some resources that you may want to consider as you're approaching any one of these issues when they come up. One is peer consultation. For those of you who have listservs for your city manager organizations, I know in Oregon they're very active in terms of sharing ideas. Local government resources like the League of Cities in your state, ICMA is a tremendous resource. The web's a tremendous resource. It's kind of a catch-22 because you have to make sure you're getting real information that's accurate, but it might help you identify other communities that are going through the same thing. And then at the risk of self-promotion, consultant assistance is always there as an option. The next one, so what are effective ways for professionals to develop their skill sets? I have to say that there is no substitution for experience. The school of hard knocks. It's like being a parent. Until you're a parent, you really don't figure it out wholly until you go through that. But there are trainings that you can go through that are helpful in giving you some of the basic skill sets. Going through trainings on communications, conflict resolution, mediation, and then going through project management, because many of these issues involve being able to do matrix management with a number of different disciplines, and being able to manage the project and the process is helpful. And I believe that's the last one. So hopefully I stayed semi on time here.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. That was very helpful, and appreciate your blend of actually being a leader in local government agencies and now your service as a consultant, and bringing in your background as well from your MPA at the University of Washington, a great set of skills and perspectives. And we'd like to move now to a polling question. So you heard a number of best practices from Eric here. And let me put out a polling question for you as to check off as many of those elements of best practices that you would like your agency to apply to help resolve tough issues. Where do you think the attention needs to go? How can you leverage some of these into good effect? And while it's happening, Eric, I'd like to go to a question that came in from our audience here. Do you have any strategies for preparing a task force if its members are not experts of the topic they are tackling and you have a short timeline? What do you do about the citizens' committees that are there to represent, you know, the rank and file of the citizenry, but, you know, they're not experts and you got a complicated issue in a short time to do it?
Okay, well, first of all, anytime you're putting together a task force, the first thing you want to do is develop the task force based on interests, not based on people. Oftentimes I'll find clients say, oh, we need this person on the task force or this person on the task force. You want to say, who do you need to have at the table? Do you need to have the chamber at the table? Do you need to have the local local county rep? Do you need to, who needs to be at the table? And figure out who can represent that constituency from the standpoint of being credible with their constituency and be able to be constructive as part of the group and represent their interests well. So that would be number one, is figuring that out and getting those folks to the table. The second thing is making sure that you're getting everybody up to speed at the same time. So that everybody has a level playing field on the information that they're discussing. And so everybody comes to the table with a different amount of knowledge. And you need to take a little bit of time to do that, even if you're in a very quick process. And the last piece I'll say is you may want to go through a quick process, but if you can make sure that you do allow enough time for the ownership to develop within that group, and make sure that the group has a clear mission, is the other thing I forgot to mention, is going to be important.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Well, I can see that the various areas of best practices that Eric outlined for you have resonated with our audience, things that they'd like to give attention to. So that's actually a perfect segue into our next segment here, which is with Holly Lee. And let me just give a moment of introduction to her. She earned her MPA from James Madison University. What she's going to be sharing with you today was kind of interesting when this first came up, because when you think about poverty and underemployment, you don't think of that necessarily as a primary and first responsibility of a city. But I think you'll discover as you listen to her story how that really is a good model for thinking about how to grapple with these issues that cities are being asked to take on that are non-traditional issues for cities, but yet critically important to their residents and where residents want to go for solutions. Her innovative program that you're going to be hearing about today has earned 4 awards from local, state, and national organizations, and she's going to be sharing with you some of the transferable lessons from that. So, Holly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. So as Don said, my name is Holly Lee, and I'm with the City of Charlottesville, which is located in Virginia, and it's in central Virginia. I'm going to be talking to you today about a workforce development training program that we developed to tackle the issue of unemployment and poverty in Charlottesville, and it's called Growing Opportunities, or GO for short. So if you hear me saying GO, that's exactly what I'm talking about. So a couple takeaways for you all, hopefully, that you'll take away from this presentation is, as Don mentioned, a non-traditional approach to for a locality to deal with the tough issue of unemployment, underemployment, and poverty, while at the same time addressing workforce needs of your organization and other employers in the area, so whether they be private sector, other nonprofits, other governments. And then hopefully you'll determine ways that you can take this model and make it applicable to your department, your locality. No matter where you sit in an organization, there should be some way to apply this model to you. So quickly, just the tough issue here in Charlottesville, something that our city council recognizes and that we deal with on a daily basis. We have a population of about 45,000 people. About 30% of city residents live in poverty, and that's about 20% of our families. And we consider poverty for a family of three to be a little above $20,000 a year. That's typically a single mother with two children. At the same time, we have a very, very highly educated workforce. So our population, most people, more than 60%, have at least an associate's degree. Most have bachelor's degrees and master's degrees and PhDs. We are proximate to the University of Virginia, the University of Virginia Health System, so that definitely brings in a very educated population. And then we also have a lot of jobs here, and a majority of them do not require that high level of education. So it really creates this situation for us where we have a highly competitive labor force, where you have people who are highly educated, who are taking up jobs that do not require high levels of education, that could be taken by individuals who have a GED, a high school diploma, or maybe not either of those, but just, you know, some school. So this is how we've tackled the issue in Charlottesville. What we've really done is assess the workforce needs of employers in the area, and we've looked introspectively as well. So within our organization, where do we have jobs that are hard to fill, where there's a lot of turnover, where we're lacking qualified job candidates? And we're looking really at jobs, semi-skilled jobs that pay a self-sufficient wage, self-sufficient here in Charlottesville. I know that fluctuates from locality to locality, but for us, it's about $13 an hour. Ideally, we target jobs that are about $15 an hour, but we do base kind of the bottom level is around $13 an hour. And then what we do is we work with the employers to identify what they need in a job candidate, and then we develop training and education that are that meet those needs, and then we train low-income city residents on those things so that they become a competitive job candidate for those positions. So what we call this specifically, the name of the model is jobs-driven workforce development, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a specific example of that. Again, you know, the focus is on the job. We start with the job first, where we know that there's a shortage of qualified job candidates. We find out exactly what the employer wants, and then we build training around that. So we really, we've over the past 3 years, we've done 13 programs. I know this show only shows 12, but we just graduated a class. We have had 97 graduates from our programs. All of those are low income. We use HUD thresholds to determine income eligibility. We've placed 92 people into employment with our target employers who are actively participating in our GO programs. And our retention rate in those jobs is approximately 75% over a three-year period. So that's fairly significant if you just look at a general applicant pool and the type of turnover rate you would have.
Holly, let me just interject here for a moment, because I think our audience would be very interested in understanding how it was that your city council decided to get into this. You know, many city leaders, both on the professional management side and on the city council side, might take a look at an issue of underemployment and say, you know, that's really an important problem, but, you know, the county needs to deal with that or somebody else needs to deal with it. Could you just describe how it was that your elected officials decided that, you know, convening this people around this topic, partnering with others and so on, was something that they wanted to play a key role in?
So our city council and the city of Charlottesville in general is very progressive minded. We are very focused on helping our lowest disadvantaged populations achieve self-sufficiency. So a report had been issued called the Orange Dot Project by the Chamber of Commerce, and in that it identified the number of households and families that live in poverty in Charlottesville. So our city council immediately reacted to that by forming an internal strategic action team. And out of that came a report called Growing Opportunity, A Path to Self-Sufficiency in Charlottesville. And one of the recommendations was to create these jobs-driven workforce development training programs. And city council made it very clear that they wanted these efforts, these workforce development efforts, which are typically done by social services or human services, to come out of the Office of Economic Development, because what we really want to do is change the model and really start with the jobs and the employers and then work from a different angle, as opposed to, okay, here's an individual who is disadvantaged, is low income, let's just give them some training and hope that they get a job. So that's really the kind of angle we came at, and City Council is extremely supportive of our office really delving into this issue and attacking it full force like we've done over the past 3 years.
Okay, so to use Eric's description, this was an example of your City Council deciding that it wanted to run towards this controversy rather than away from it and say it's somebody else's problem.
Exactly. We said these are our city residents. We are going to help them as much as we can to address this issue and help them achieve their goals in life. So, yes, we've said it's our responsibility, and we're going to jump full force in.
Okay. So share with us how you partnered with other organizations in your community and how you went about doing this. And I see you've got some examples to share with us. So thank you for giving us some concrete context for what you did and how it worked.
Sure. So a good example of how we collaborate with our partners in the community is our pilot program, which we launched in October of 2014. It was the first program that we did. It's called Go Driver. Basically, what happened was that a staff person in our office is on the CAT, or the Charlottesville Area Transit Advisory Board. He came back and said that they were having a problem finding bus drivers. And so we said, okay, well, we'll help them with that. And so we immediately contacted our local community college, Piedmont Virginia Community College, developed a curriculum. And we, based on what the employer, Charlottesville Area Transit, told us what they wanted, they really said that if you can get us an individual who has good customer service skills, we'll teach them how to drive a bus. So we brought in our partner, again, the community college, the employer, and then other workforce development service providers in the community to help us identify people for the program. We do have a lot of outreach efforts within the Office of Economic Development, but it's always good to help have the support of our other workforce providers like Aging and Rehab Services and the Virginia Employment Commission and the Workforce Center. So all of those individuals are partners in this program. So this is, again, our pilot, Go Driver. We had 12 people in the program. So we do a recruitment process. Then they interview, they apply, they interview, and then they're selected. There's some pre-screening stuff that we do. But then once they start the program, for this group, we had 12 people. 12 people graduated from the program, and 12 people were offered employment. One decided to stay where he was because it wasn't a transportation-related industry, but the other 11 went to work with Charlottesville Area Transit, and we have 7 that are still there after 3 years, and 3 others have gone to other transit agencies in the area, but they're still driving, so that's our goal there. And then we had one individual who unfortunately became unemployed and did not get employment again. But another part of this is our supportive services that we offer, and this is also outside of the realm of economic development and maybe even local governments in general, outside of social services and human services. But we work with our supportive service partners in the community to make sure that people have access to transportation, childcare, anything that would prohibit them from continuing the training and successfully completing it, and then once they're on the job, making sure that they're actually able to be successful in that job. So hopefully that answered your question on collaborations. That's a group, the previous picture was a group that we took a picture of just more recently, but it was a small group, about 20. In totality, we've placed about 50 into Charlottesville Area Transit, and 70% are still there after 3 years. So we're really happy with those numbers, and that's much higher than what they typically would have with a general applicant pool. This picture that you see is of a woman who went through our second Go Driver cohort. She actually went to school bus, our city school bus system, and she also works for Charlottesville Area Transit. So she's definitely got more skills and is, able to drive for more agencies here in the area. But she's an example of an individual who had lived in public housing her whole life and was able to achieve self-sufficiency. And her son has also gone through the program. He also drives for school bus. And so now they're, in a place where they have their own transportation. They have, their own, housing that's not subsidized anymore. So definitely we're seeing economic impact of this particular program. We've also taken the model and done it in different industries. So we did a program called Go Office, and that was office administration. And that's an area where we have a lot of highly educated individuals who fill those positions that really only require a GED or a high school diploma because just of our demographic, again, here in Charlottesville. But this one, we worked with a company called GovSmart. It's an IT company here in Charlottesville, and there's 2 individuals there who were placed, and they've been there for over 2 years now. They're doing great. And again, they're also examples of people who have transportation now, out of public housing. One of them went on a company trip to Hawaii because her sales were higher than everybody else. So it's just one of those things, you see people's lives changing. We've also got into the skilled trades area. So this is an area for opportunity in the city of Charlottesville. We do not have any manufacturing here, which has caused some of our compression issues that we have, where we have either people who are high skilled and in good jobs or low skilled and in entry level positions like food service and retail, things like that. But this is an area where we do have jobs, but we don't have people who are trained to fill those jobs. So So we've begun working with employers in the skilled trades, so like construction, electric, plumbing, HVAC, and Go Electric was a partnership with Design Electric in Charlottesville, and we've done two cohorts with them and had some really good placement rates. We've had a couple individuals who have continued on into an apprenticeship program, so doing very well. We also did Go Utilities, which was with our City of Charlottesville Public Utilities Division. That was a small cohort of four. They were all placed. They're all still employed there. We have two getting ready to enter an apprenticeship program. They're making $14 an hour, fully benefited position, and doing very well. So, again, that's an example where not only were we helping low-income city residents get the skills and the training that they need to become competitive in the job market, but at the same time, we were also meeting the City of Charlottesville's workforce needs because those positions were just very high turnover. And what we have found is that people who go through our programs have a lot of loyalty to the employers who go through the program. So the retention rate, again, is much higher than with the general applicant pool. Just some upcoming things that we've done. We have really, the unemployment rate is much lower than it was 3 years ago when we started these initiatives. We're about 3.5% on a regular and consistent basis. We're at full employment, you know, given that number. So we're starting to work with individuals who are very entry level, who have multiple barriers to employment, to really get them into the workforce. But we also, again, work with the Go programs with the underemployed. But then we're developing this arm for individuals who are in the most entry level spots. So we're doing a skilled trades academy with our Charlottesville area technical education center, where people will get a little exposure to the various skilled trades in the area. They'll do tours, they'll meet employers, we'll place them into entry-level field labor type positions. We are really getting into the apprenticeship programs, getting employers enrolled in that program, helping to pay for apprenticeships. We're also doing some GED stuff that we've never done before. So this is new for us. We just started it because really what we know is that the key to getting a job, a good job, a job that leads to self-sufficiency is education. And so for those that don't have a GED, it's really hard to compete. So we started these integrated education programs where we're integrating education, so like healthcare for the Go GED Pathways program, with GED prep, so in this case math and science, and getting people ready to sit for their GED. So that's kind of the track we're on now. And that kind of gets me to some of my closing remarks where you think about lessons learned. The main thing is that you really want to make sure that you have a committed employer, and this is critical to the jobs-driven workforce development model. If you have an employer who is not committed, is kind of wishy-washy on whether or not they're going to entertain the individuals once they complete the program, don't have the program. And we've actually canceled programs before because when we got to the end, we had employers who said, oh, well, maybe we're not going to do this, or maybe we're not going to take the person. And really, the thing with this whole, the whole model is based on the fact that we have a job. If you successfully complete, you are going to be a competitive candidate. So there is no reason why an employer should not consider you for employment. So that's one of the things. And with Charlottesville Area Transit, they consider this program, and this is where you get full embracement, they consider this program their own. They are part of us now. There's so many connections, so we're proud to have that partnership. Make sure that all your partners understand what your goals are and that they understand their role. So this kind of program has multiple components, and everybody needs to stay in their lane. And we found before where people have tried to, you know, if they're offering training, they're also trying to do supportive services. We try to get people to do what they do best. And so if you're a trainer, you train. If you need transportation, I'll get you to the right person. But just making sure everybody knows their role and that they stick to it. Again, the supportive services are critical. If we didn't have those in place, we would have a lot of people who would not have made it through training and then would not have been successful in the job. So the example of the woman who was driving the school bus that you saw the picture of, she almost got let go from school bus within the first 3 weeks of employment because her car broke down, and she was too ashamed to tell me. The employer called me and said, Holly, she's not getting to work because her car's broken down. So we went out and helped her get a car, a reliable transportation. So we helped her with a down payment on a nice used car. So she's been there ever since. So there's one of those things you got to have it in place. And again, make sure you're flexible and that you remain relevant. So what we're finding now with almost full employment, we need to make sure that we're staying relevant. We can't do the same old thing and expect to be successful. So we started to shift, you know, now we're serving, you know, the most entry-level individuals and trying to even get them introduced into an environment where they feel like, yeah, I might be getting a job here where I can be self-sufficient. And then finally, just again, just to go over the presentation takeaways. So, you know, hopefully you've learned a little bit about the jobs-driven workforce development model, that it's a non-traditional way that a local government can tackle a tough issue like underemployment or unemployment and poverty, and then at the same time address your own workforce needs. So, you know, it's a win-win situation. We have people who get jobs and their lives change, and we as an organization that needs to operate and run on a 24/7 basis has the staff we need to do so. And then hopefully you can see ways that this model could be applicable to your agency, organization, department, no matter where you sit, like transit. Who would think transit and economic development would have such a close connection? Healthcare, utilities, skilled trades, all those areas. I mean, I have people come in with me with all kind of go ideas. So there's a place for this in about every field. So with this, and I know you all are going to get a PDF of this, I've included links to the various reports that we've done. The first one was the Growing Opportunity Report that kicked all of this off, and it was created for City Council. It has about 120 recommendations. This was only one of the recommendations in there. We also have done updates over the past few years, so you can kind of see where we are now and where we plan to go. So that's all I have.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much, Holly. And there's a lot of questions that have popped up along the way here, and I want to have us address some of them. People are interested in knowing, you know, how did you get the funding for a program like this? What could they do to tap some similar or parallel resources in their own communities and other localities and states?
Sure. So, again, our city council is very supportive of this. So they initially gave us $200,000 right off the bat to do this. I know a lot of localities aren't that fortunate. So there are grants that we have applied for and successfully received in order to subsidize and leverage that local money. So we've gotten grants through the Department of Social Services. We've gotten specifically for TANF recipients, so SNAP, people who are on food stamps. People into the VUE program, the Welfare to Work program. We've gotten grants from our community college. So a lot of states, they will have grants available for individuals who are getting credentials, and we've leveraged those dollars a lot. We also use the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Grant to help pay for individuals to go through training. So our average cost of training for a student is somewhere between $2,500 and $3,000, depending on you know, what kind of credentialing they're getting. And by the time we're done, the city is usually paying between $500 and $700 of that after we leverage all of those additional funds that are out there. So I'm not sure what other states have, but I'm sure there's probably some equivalent of that somewhere within the state.
Okay, great. So one of the other questions that came in, somebody was listening to your discussion about the overqualified workforce, and how did you, they want you to elaborate a little bit, how do you solve that with training? And what was your technique for dealing with overqualified people?
So overqualified people, they don't really have any trouble finding jobs. And so what's really happening is they're taking the jobs that don't require that high level of qualification or education. So our focus has really been dealing with the individuals who just can't compete at that level. And so, you know, like for Charlottesville Area Transit, people get their commercial driver's license, they get customer service training, they get their career readiness certificate, they get their passenger service and safety certification. Those are all things that the employer specifically said they wanted. And so at the end of the day, when that individual goes and applies for that job, if they're applying against someone who has a master's degree and a CDL, they're still at that level and able to compete with them because they have the credential, plus they have all these other certifications that the employer said that they wanted. So we're really just trying to give these individuals a level playing field against that.
Okay. So one of the things that comes up around this is, you know, what were some of the spin-off benefits that you saw from this program? In other words, you certainly helped these people who were unemployed or underemployed, and so you've helped those individuals across. What has it done to the fabric of your community that you took on this gnarly problem and you're reaching out to take a stand and to help these folks? How did your community respond to you doing this, and are there sort of community benefits beyond the individual benefits of the people that participate?
There is. I mean, you would not believe. It's really funny when you talk to some of our GO drivers and some of the people who have been through other GO programs, they call it the GO family. It's really a, and everywhere you go in the community, you hear about the GO program. You need to go through a GO program, or have you heard about the GO program? So what's really happened is word has spread because the results are there. When you go through our program and you do what you need to do and you do it with a good attitude, and you're gonna more than likely get the job that you've been training for. And so now we have all these people who are kind of in the beginning, our partners. Some of the partners were a little bit naysayers. They were like, well, you know, I don't know if that's gonna work, and you know. And so now people are coming around after 3 years and saying, we want to work with you. We want to be good partners with you, and because you can show results. So now we see spinoffs of our model being used by other organizations and agencies. Even our surrounding county has tried to do something related to this, and has actually just did outreach to us recently to see how we might be able to work together. So, you know, it's really starting to be one of those things where, you know, people are recognizing the results in the communities. They're like, oh, wow, that's a really good thing. Most of the people that come to us now, it's through word of mouth. So everybody in our current GO driver training program knows somebody who graduated from a GO driver training program. So there's definitely been a community thread and support throughout.
Okay. So let's take a look at a polling questionnaire. I know we've got some other questions that are coming in. I'm going to try to also reach out to some audience members that are raising their hand here. So which of these insights from tackling community needs would you like to apply in your agency? There are a number of things that are takeaways, I think, from the case study that Holly shared with you that could be looked at to address other challenges that I hear from city managers and organizations and city councils around the country, the opioid crisis, the homelessness, et cetera. What are things that you think would be transferable to you, and how could you see those particular opportunities come along? And while that's happening, I want to address a couple of things that came in here as questions. There are digital, if you came in a little bit late and didn't hear the preamble, we do have digital recordings of these sessions. They're available within 24 hours, and we send an automatic notice to the person who registered in your agency for this session. You can also get a copy of the PowerPoint presentation in PDF form right now, right in GoToWebinar under the handout section. So all those resources are available to you, and we encourage you to access them. So let's take a look at what we're seeing in the results here. Okay, identifying and engaging the committed partners is huge. That's absolutely critical, and leveraging agency resources and opportunities. Yeah, that was a very interesting element of your story, Holly, was how you discovered after you got into this that, well, this isn't just helping the people who need jobs. This is actually helping the city solve issues for itself. And I'm wondering if a similar sort of creative perspective could be helpful for cities that think, for example, about other chronic problems that may exist in their community, whether it's, you know, transportation challenges or homelessness or opioid crisis or whatever. You know, what would be actually ways that it could be a win-win opportunity versus just, you know, a pouring of resources into a target population, which I think is a more typical and traditional way of thinking about these issues. So thanks for opening our eyes to the opportunities here and to seeing the potential that this has.
Thank you.
So we're going to turn now to our next presenter. Let me get him on the screen here. And that's Kip Harkness. And Kip earned his master's in urban planning from Florida State University. He is a social entrepreneur. That's my characterization of him. He's out making interesting and exciting things happen. Some of you may have heard him in his presentation in San Antonio at the ICMA annual conference. But he's worked literally from Timbuktu to Silicon Valley, implementing programs that have been over $300 million of successful projects in that community, and is going to be sharing with you a really interesting story with, again, transferable lessons to many other domains about how you can address emergency situations or the left field issues that you were hearing about from Eric at the beginning, and what you can do to address those successfully. So, Kip, thanks so much for joining us today. And Kip is joining us actually from the Kettering Institute in Ohio. And so you're seeing in the background the things that are actually in his borrowed office. So that's not necessarily Kip's message to you, but the message of his host, although he probably would identify with a number of those. So, Kip, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate you doing this from the road.
Thank you very much, Don. A mentor of mine once told me that the higher you go, right, that the less you know. And now that I'm a busy executive in my own right and kind of unfortunately personify that statement, I always appreciate an executive summary version of whatever someone is going to talk about. So let me give you that in one slide, which you see here. Bottom line, when 13 feet of water is flowing uncontrolled over the top of your largest dam, bad things are going to happen. And you need to be prepared to respond, I would argue, in three ways. One is you need to be able to be compassionate in action. Two is you need to be able to have open, candid, and direct conversations. And three, you really need to work as one single team. And so what I'll talk about here is the experience in San Jose, and kind of use that as a guiding story to look at some practical tools. In February 2017, we had the rainiest winter in about 20 years in Northern California, and a raging waterfall, which you saw on the last slide, poured over our reservoir and began to flood along Coyote Creek, affecting three of our neighborhoods. And I'm going to tell that story and discuss these three principles, which guided what I would argue is our successful recovery. With each principle, as I said, I'll give you some practical tools you can put into practice in any disaster recovery situation, whether that's a hurricane or a fire or a flood. And if you don't think that it's going to, if you think it's not going to happen to you, think again. The flood event hit us after 5 years of drought. It was the last thing we thought was going to happen, but it did. So for me, when I walked in to take command of the Emergency Operations Center, 7 p.m., 21st of February, 2017, the floods were already underway, with a massive flow of water causing the creek to surge over its bank and flow into some of our most vulnerable neighborhoods, where immigrants and first-generation families squeeze into cramped housing and really are trying to live their piece of the American dream. We had the largest evacuation in the history of San Jose. I'll give you the flood by the numbers. We had 14,000 people evacuated. 800 had to be rescued in boats like this. 230 people in our shelter for a number of weeks, 500 homes damaged, 300 cars or more lost, all told at least $100 million in damage to both public and private property. So having just given you the numbers, let me contradict myself by saying that our first guiding principle is actually not about the numbers at all. That first night and morning in the Emergency Operations Center, we formulated the first principle. Be compassion in action. The people at the center of how we think, how we act, everything has to start from this place of compassion. Now that I've clearly established that I'm from Northern California, the obvious question comes up. Well, what does it mean to be compassion in action in practice? So for us, first thing is to realize that it is not about you and what you normally do. That's one of the things you've got to get through hard and fast with everyone in the organization, starting with yourself. Whatever other work you're doing, you're not going to be doing it. If you are a disaster service worker, and if you're a city employee, you are a disaster service worker. Check your contract. It's in there. Then you're dropping everything else when you're called to respond to an emergency situation like this. For me, that meant dropping 22 innovation and technology projects that I was leading at City Hall, and on a personal note, canceling a long-planned one-week consulting gig to Singapore, which you see pictured here where my hotel view would have been, and just literally tossing the cost of those tickets out the door and a very, very lucrative private consulting fee in the bargain. So what do? You let it go. Right? It's not about you. It's about the people who've been affected by the flood. And that's what we feel being compassion in action means. It's really putting people like Mrs. Hen Nguyen here at the center of our thoughts and our work. Ms. Nguyen worked with the Americans in Vietnam, and for that she was punished by having all of her things taken away and being put into a communist re-education camp. When she managed to flee to the United States, she reestablished herself and her life and was very proud to not once have taken public assistance. Here she is being forced to flee again from her home, taking everything that she owns in that little satchel for the second time in her life. This is the proper focus of our compassion. So if that's the compassion side, where's the action? The action, I argue, has to come in the form of immediate relevant help. We asked for volunteers to come clean up neighborhoods, parks, and homes as soon as the floodwaters began to recede. 4,000 people responded and gave their time and skills, and with their assistance, we removed about 7,500 metric tons of debris. To put that in perspective, a very large male elephant is up to about 7.5 metric tons. So the largest elephant you've ever seen, imagine him, and then 999 of his best friends and relatives. And that's how much debris we removed with the help of these volunteers. And we ended up removing it well past the point that FEMA would reimburse because, again, we wanted to be compassion in action. Compassion in action, I would argue, also means money. As my 13-year-old son said the other day when we were talking about potential birthday gifts options, he said, well, who doesn't like money? And we immediately, in the case of the flood, set up a crowdfunding platform to raise money for flood relief and recovery. Mr. Q Hong, he of the very bright pants off to the left there, responded, pulled out his checkbook. He was planning to write a check for us for $3 million. He ended up writing a check for $5 million on his personal checking account, which is pretty damn cool when a check that big clears on your personal account. But he also set the standard, and 3,000 other people followed him, donating what they could afford and raising an additional $2 million directly going to the flood relief. We immediately put the money to use, providing $3,000 in cash to each household that had been affected and covering the cost of temporary housing for all who needed it in one of the most expensive housing markets in the world. So that's the compassion in action. The pro tips, the takeaways are, one, letting go of all of your other work. Two, making time to get out in the field and listen to people. My conversations with Ms. Nguyen and others were really instrumental in reminding me, when I was in the lockbox of the Emergency Operations Center, why we were doing this and how we need to do our work. Asking volunteers to help, this is sort of obvious, but it's helpful to remember that the number one reason that people volunteer is somebody asks them. So if you don't ask, they probably aren't going to show up. Ask them, and ask them to give money too, crowdsource that money. And then finally, remind the team that's doing the work every day that it's all about the people. We would start each shift in the EOC and end each shift in the EOC with a story of the day from about a real person and a refresher on these three principles, which I'm talking about now. It kept us focused. And compassion in action doesn't have to mean big things. It doesn't have to mean thousands of volunteers. It's also the small things. Here you see a volunteer from Jews Chi, a Buddhist relief organization. I remember one of their volunteers was in the shelter, and he had one small job: to make sure that people's hands were sanitized when they entered the shelter. Very small job, but very important to prevent the spread of disease in a very crowded environment. Now, he could have nagged, or he could have barked, or he could have directed, or he could have yelled or shouted at people. Instead, he invited with compassion. Time to sanitize. And he made it sound like an invitation to a vacation in Hawaii. I actually started to look forward to my time to sanitize then every night that I would go and visit the shelter. And that's the difference that compassion action can make, the small things. Second guiding principle: open, candid, and direct. We are a large bureaucracy in San Jose. We have about 6,200 people that work for us, and we pride ourselves in our California way of being very considerate. We have conversations, we kind of meander, we're a little indirect. But disaster is no time for bureaucratic response or indirect, overly polite, meandering conversations. In this case, this principle I channel and can credit my father with helping me on this. He was a Marine colonel and taught me early on the importance of facing the brutal facts and speaking directly and candidly to each other about the issues at hand. So two small examples. One was at scale with our council and our public. We held a public hearing on March 9th, just a couple of weeks after the flood itself. We still had the Emergency Operations Center full swing, going 24/7 at this point. But our Marin Council had asked to hold this public hearing to say what went wrong and what were we doing. When I initially heard this idea, when I'm in the middle of the response in the Emergency Operations Center, I really thought it was, you know, bat spit crazy and that it was something we shouldn't do. Now, after the fact, I realize that it is extremely important. We admitted our mistake in not notifying people soon enough, and we apologized. For every person who testified with a need or a problem in that room that day, we had a huge room full of relief workers off to the side, and we matched them up person to person individually with the programs and the assistance that they needed right then and there. Second example of being open, candid, and direct allowed us to rapidly learn from a mistake that we'd made in how we dealt with homeless. We had essentially excluded the homeless from the relief effort based on some decisions made by frontline staff that they were not affected in the same way as people with homes. Through candid conversation, we learned of this at the executive level. We debated it and quickly decided to provide relief support to all people who had been affected by the flood, regardless of whether they'd had a home to start with or had just recently become homeless. So open, candid, and direct, the pro tips on this one is really about facing the brutal facts, admitting your own mistakes, and seeking and providing direct feedback in real time or as near to real time as you can. And then doing something with it, right? Learning quickly and improving to take immediate action. Open and candid and direct can also mean little things as well, just like compassion in action. Through candid conversation, for example, we learned very quickly that while we were providing hot, nutritious meals at our shelter, they were not the kind of meals that our elderly Vietnamese refugees were comfortable eating. And so we shifted very quickly. We provided more culturally appropriate food that allowed people to eat what they wanted, what was comfortable to them, which is actually really important in an emergency situation, is comfort food, and allowed them to stay healthy because they were eating enough nutritious food. Third and final guiding principle, one team. No one gets left behind. And that means making sure that the traditional departmental lines, those are broken down, making sure that we are thinking beyond even the city as a team and inviting in our nonprofit and community partners. This notion of one team was particularly important in our bustling Emergency Operations Center, which you see here, when we brought together a myriad of departments, some of whom don't usually work with each other, and a constantly expanding and changing group of individuals as we adapted the structure to include shift from the response to the relief to the ultimate recovery. The recovery in particular became pretty difficult to organize and was a massive and somewhat chaotic workflow. And so it was hard to keep the entire team focused on both the right stuff and fully engaged in the work in a way that they were contributing strongly. So for this, we stole a tool from tech. We're here in Silicon Valley, and we stole the tool of Scrum. Scrum, for those of you who haven't heard it, is an agile methodology of team management. And essentially, it breaks down the work into manageable chunks and then puts a time box around the work in a series of short sprints. In our case, the sprints were only a day long. Following this along here, you can see on the left, as tasks, requests, priorities come in from the mayor, from the city council, from the field, you are able to put them in a backlog in the red. And at start of each shift, we were able to pull out a short list of the most important actions of the day. That's our orange sprint scope. And throughout the course of the day, focus on implementing them with a time for reflection and improvement built in every single day. The result in our case, the green on the right, is not reusable software, but an effective flood recovery operation. So here you see the Scrum in effect in our Emergency Operations Center. You can see our Scrum board, our Kanban board, where we have on the left our backlog, and then the swim lanes about what's important today, prioritizing the nice to have, highly desirable, and non-negotiable. And then off to the right, you can see we're kind of in the middle of the day already. We've got a lot of work in progress. And then the far right is our done board. So piece here, you remember earlier the EOC, you saw everybody wearing a colored vest. Here, the color of the stickies corresponds to the color of the vest of the section. So I've got orange for my operations section. I got blue for my plan section. I got yellow for my logistics. And so any section chief, or in fact anybody, can take a quick glance at the board and understand in real time, with a quick visual diagram here, where they are and where they aren't in terms of the top priorities for the day. And the clear, structured approach of Scrum helped us operate as one team and focus on the most important issues without distraction. And one team goes beyond, as I said, the city, it goes beyond the community as well. And remember that your state is part of your one team. So we reached out to the state and our state legislators, and we asked for the help. They responded with a special appropriation of $5.4 million that was on top of the $6 million that we've been able to privately raise. And they tell us it was in large measure because of the amount that we had privately raised that they were able to push this forward, to continue supporting all of those who were displaced by the flood. And I think one of the challenges for one team is that once the immediate crisis has passed, especially if it's localized to certain neighborhoods, it's very easy for those of us in City Hall to forget that we're still in a recovery. This picture was taken a few weeks after the flood, and it certainly doesn't look like we're in a deep crisis. So why not just go back to business as usual? Well, the reason, of course, is that recovery is a marathon, right? It takes time and effort, and it keeps going and going. And the last mile is the hardest, right? Here you see us continuing to remove debris months after the flood had taken place, because many people didn't have the resources to begin immediately rebuilding. They went in a couple of months later to really gotten their stuff together, and they realized, I've got all this junk that's either still partially wet, or I just need to get rid of it because I'm going to redo the whole thing. And they need to get rid of that debris. Now, none of this is reimbursable by FEMA, and technically we should or could tell people to, you know, buy your own bin, deal with your own garbage. But our one team commitment at this point was that no one gets left behind. And we knew a lot of the people who were doing this work now, later, were doing it this way because they were the ones who didn't have ready cash to begin the development and the reconstruction. They were the single family homeowners who would held on to that home in Silicon Valley, the elderly, and the others who didn't have the resources. So we kept going through the last mile. So the one team takeaways: let go of department lines and normal hierarchy, expand the team to include community and nonprofits. Think about adopting frameworks like Scrum or Agile approaches that allow for flexibility and clarity of the team. Reach out to your state partners and your legislators. And again, that last mile is the longest, so don't quit. And, you know, it's interesting, persistence and grit are really key here in recovery, as opposed to the response where you can do it on adrenaline, and the relief where you actually have a lot of other people and an early burst of interest. The recovery requires persistence and grit. There was an interesting study that was done a while back on Navy SEAL training, which is one of the most rigorous training programs that exists in the world and has a very high washout dropout rate. And they wanted to see what's the difference between the people who make it through and those people who get washed out. Because obviously we don't want anybody to wash out. We want to just select the right people and have everybody make it on through. And what they found was very interesting. The people who washed out actually weren't any weaker or dumber or less courageous. In fact, they were quite strong, smart, and courageous. The difference was the people who made it through didn't quit. Now, that may sound like a tautology. Of course they didn't quit. That's how they make it through. But what they had was, from the beginning, they were determined not to quit. Whatever happened, they were not going to stop. And that persistence was what led to their success in the Navy SEAL training. So we've got to have the same persistence in responding to recovery of a crisis like this. Bottom line, be compassionate in action. be open, candid, and direct, and work as one team. So that when Hin Nguyen, who you see here, say we want her to be able to move back to her home, safe, sound, dry, and have tea. And that's, I'm happy to announce, where she is right now. So out of all the things I talked about, the one that I would highlight, my kind of top pro tip, if you will, is that I feel that the most potential to transform public sector is actually this tool that I talked about called Scrum. I've included two short articles that get you started if you want to bring a bit of Silicon Valley pixie dust to your city team. The first at top is an article by Michelle Tong on my team that describes our own team's journey in adopting Scrum to guide the innovation network in City of San Jose. And the second is a six pages, guide to Scrum that illustrates everything you need to get started. So with that, I will close with gratitude and appreciation of the flood recovery team of 300 people in the City of San Jose, the 30 community organizations, the 4,000 volunteers, the 3,000 donors, who together were compassion in action, open, candid, and direct, and one team. Thank you.
Outstanding. Thank you very much, Kip. Very inspiring story that you share with us here. And I want to be sure that we really help clarify and reinforce some of the important things that you brought about here with this polling question. So we're asking the fifth of our six polling questions. We'll ask another one at the end of what you want to take away from all this. But we'd like to get see how many of these emergency response ideas and approaches that Kip was sharing with you would you like your agency to consider? And so we'll take a look at that. And meanwhile, I'm going to be inviting the rest of our presenters back onto the webcams here, because we're going to cover a few other items and welcome additional comments. So we encourage you to be coming back with that. And again, I'm taking a look at any questions or other things that are out there that people would like to be asking. Please send them in. We're welcoming your active involvement, and I'm looking to see how we can use some of our tools here to be hearing from you and picking up the things that you'd like to be addressing along the way. Okay. So I'm seeing lots of responses here, and let's take a look at what the results are. And coming back, here are our results. So I can see across the board that people were resonating from what you were hearing with regard to Kip's sharing of their approach and ways that you could do it. And again, I think this is, as Kip was highlighting, you know, we went into some detail in these two case studies, because the more detail you go in, the more robust the stories become in terms of how they could be applicable to other situations. So I'd invite you to step back and say, okay, what are the kind of emergency circumstances that might arise in our community? And how can we be using some of the principles that you see here and that Kip was laying out in your circumstances? So we're going to take some additional questions. Here's where you can contact our presenters, and we encourage you to do so. So we have some post-webinar questions, and that's exactly what I was just starting to tee up for you. You know, take a few moments and talk about, you know, what are the challenging, controversial issues in your community? What strategies and tactics do you want to pick up? What resources would you like to tap to do that? And what questions might you have for our panelists here as we have our closing minutes? But meanwhile, I have another polling question for you, which is we'd like to see, you know, the big thing is not just what was presented to you, but is what you take away. So we'd like you to take a moment and click off as many of the items as you found of value for yourself, or you think of would be of value to your organization. So maybe there are things that you knew about, but gosh, this would be a great way through the webinar and sharing the materials to extend that knowledge out to other people in your organization. So click off as many as you see are relevant there for you. And meanwhile, I'll take a look at additional questions. There's a couple coming up here with regard to the Scrum. That is, Give us an example of maybe some other projects. Are there sort of some non-emergency issues where you've used Scrum in local government? Could you just expand on that a little bit? I think people are intrigued by the tool, but wondering, okay, how could they use it more broadly? And how do you get set up to use Scrum, to be ready to use Scrum, you know, when the emergency is just going to pop on you and you're, you know, won't have time to prepare?
Right. Excellent question. So Scrum is actually very well suited to any task or project or even policy that you're working on where you have a notion of where you want to get to, but you're not clear on how you're going to get there. So as opposed to a waterfall planning where you know every single step and you can schedule everything in advance, it's really, really good at things like, okay, we're going to change how we do our talent recruitment, so let's use Scrum to manage that. Okay, I've got my innovation roadmap in 22 different projects. Let me use an approach to Scrum to use that. I'm developing a new policy, but I don't know what it's going to be. Let me use Scrum. So it's basically a more agile framework, and it's team-based, not individual-based, so that you can set the team in motion toward where you want to go. The use of it in the emergency response is actually a little bit radical. It has to overlay on the existing incident command system and other formal systems that are there because you don't want to mess with those. So I would say, you know, don't necessarily jump into use of Scrum for your first time in a disaster situation if you haven't used it before. And probably the best way to learn about it is to reach out into your community. If you have even a small bit of tech in your community, there are practitioners of Scrum who you can tap into, and they can give you some advice. Now, they're going to be used to using it for software, so they may be a little scratching their own head at this use in public sector environment, but they can give you a real hands-on approach to how you do this and the daily ceremonies and rituals around Scrum that are, frankly, very easy to adopt with any willing team.
Okay, super. Thank you. And as we can see from your responses, you got a lot of value out of the best practices, the case examples, and the approaches you'd like to carry further. And in fact, I got a question here. Someone asked you about the polling questions, and finding the polling questions and the responses very useful. I do compile those, and they're put at the back of the agenda packet. When that's compiled and available in 24 hours, along with a digital recording, exactly for the purpose of making that information available so that when you talk with your city or county or special district team or with your elected officials about the ideas that you experienced here, you can share with them what were the responses of other locations, and oftentimes that stimulates people to action, seeing, oh, lots of people are thinking about doing this. How could we do it? It helps you make your case and get traction in doing these, and which is exactly why we offer those polling questions for you, and we compile them. So let's take a look at a few final items here and some final questions. I think one of the questions that's coming up is if people want to be applying these insights more fully, are there communities of practice around dealing with tough issues that you find supportive in your location that maybe people could replicate in other areas, or communities of practice around in the larger ICMA or other environments that could help people develop those resources and ideas? And while that's going on, I'll go through a few slides here of where some resources at icma.org/coaching. But who'd like to pick that up and offer some ideas about how to, you know, get critical mass to get these ideas rolling in their organizations? Would like to be the first. Step in.
So I would just say very briefly that I think there's interesting community of practice around this. Part of what I found is things that cross sector lines. So sticking a little bit with the Scrum, but the tough issues in general, we found great value by reaching out to some of our private sector partners in tech to think about everything from how we reform the way we do the hiring to if I could, you know, use Holly's example. I thought it was brilliant the way that she reached out to the actual employers and the people who represent them to do that. And that's beyond sort of the, you know, a chickens approach that we sometimes do, at least in our own city.
Any other suggestions from Eric or Holly? Eric, we can't hear you. You're on mute.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I think Kip's point is well taken. And in terms of, you know, looking outside, and one of the things that I talked about during the course of my presentation was being able to reach out to other jurisdictions and seeing how they're dealing with situations. And that's, at least here in our community, that's particularly helpful. I know that the cities within Oregon are very much engaged in terms of sharing information and best practices. So that would be my biggest piece of advice. And
okay.
In line with Kip.
Thank you. Holly, any closing thought that you'd like to offer?
No, I would just echo those comments as well. Definitely looking at the private sector and the way that they do things, it's very different. It's very different than the way we do things in the public sector. So I think we have a lot to learn there. In terms of, you know, how things are done more quickly without as much red tape, that's something that we have tried to incorporate into our into the way we operate, because with private sector, they need employees yesterday. So we move fast, and we are very flexible and very agile. So we set a calendar for a training program, and that calendar changes maybe 10 times within that week, because we're trying to meet the employer's needs and the, you know, and the students and how are they progressing. So, yeah, I would look to the private sector and really change that mindset.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Well, we're at our time, and I want to encourage everybody to do the post-webinar survey. We're especially interested in the topics that you would like us to address in the 2018 ICMA Coaching Program webinars, so be sure to share those and other feedback with us. We continuously improve the program, and your thoughts, ideas, and requests are a critical part of that. So I want to thank our presenters, Eric Jensen of Jensen Strategies, Holly Lee, who is the presenter for the city of Charlottesville for her case study, and Kip Harkness for his case study from the city of San Jose. Thank you all so much for participating and presenting and all the work you did in the preparation for today's session. And I want to thank our audience for being so interested in this topic and sharing your ideas and reactions to it. So this is Don Maruska on behalf of the ICMA Coaching Program, thanking you all for joining us today, and look forward to your participation and other opportunities to advance your career in your organization and serve your communities at icma.org/coaching. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.